The World is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The White House says contact tracing, no thanks, even though they hosted a now infamous super spreader event. Doctors say they have to investigate.
We can't think that these people at these events live in their own bubble. They go back to their families, they go back to their communities, they go out to restaurants.
Also today, first-time voters are casting ballots this week. We hear from a young Latina in a critical swing state. She is worn out by the president.
That man can't represent me. He doesn't even want to.
And New Zealand has largely beat back the coronavirus, thanks to...
In a world of strong men, a nice lady came along.
The Jacinda Ardern puppet is here, and she's not messing around. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. President Trump's top military advisors, including the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, have gone into quarantine. They've taken this step after the vice commandant of the U.S. Coast Guard, Admiral Charles Ray, learned that he is infected with the coronavirus. Admiral Ray had been at the Pentagon last week for meetings with other military leaders. Joining me now is Leon Panetta, a former Secretary of Defense, Director of the CIA, and White House Chief of Staff. Secretary Panetta, how significant is this news today?
Well, it's of concern. Because first and foremost, anytime the president is ill or incapacitated, it raises national security implications. And now to have the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and other military leaders perhaps impacted, that raises concerns about, again, the leadership at the Pentagon at a time of crisis.
Given General Milley's rank, how will he stay on top of the U.S. military around the globe? Does he have a full classified communication suite in his home?
Well, he certainly has a great deal of communication. More importantly, he does have a deputy who operates under him and usually will run the Joint Chiefs of Staff in his absence. So I'm sure there are individuals who can assume the roles of those that have been impacted. And that gives me some degree of confidence that the business of our defense in this country is going to continue to be protected. But the fact that it's happening, the fact that our leadership is being impacted, sends a signal to our adversaries that we are in a vulnerable state.
Yeah, I mean, the very idea that adversaries might try to take advantage of this moment, how much does that worry you?
It worries me a lot. I think that's when you put our intelligence people on highest alert to make sure that they are watching our adversaries, make sure that they're looking for any indication that they may try to take advantage of it. This puts the biggest burden, very frankly, on our intelligence gathering capacity.
President Trump, as we know, is unpredictable. There are reports that senior defense officials like Secretary Mark Esper and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff General Milley reportedly have come up with their own strategies for working with him. What's wrong with that picture, and how should these battle-tested generals be dealing with their nominal boss who won't wear a mask?
Well, it's a crazy approach to national security, that's for sure, to have problems with regards to whether or not the president is going to take precautions in dealing with his military and national security leadership. And the people in national security have to worry about whether or not they want to have any direct contact with the president of the United States. Look, I think the most important thing that can happen now is for the president to take care of the COVID-19 that he has, get well, become, you know, not contagious, and regain and recover from what has happened. That's the most important thing. And in the interim, it's necessary for the president's chief of staff and the vice president to be able to make sure that they're conducting the activities that are important to our national security.
Should we have confidence in our leadership to get this right?
Well, we absolutely have to be prepared to defend this country under any circumstances. And whether the president is incapacitated, whether the leadership of this country is being impacted by COVID-19, it is absolutely essential that the administration take steps to make sure that we have people in backup positions to ensure that we are protected. Look, we have the strongest military on the face of the earth. I'm not worried about our ability to respond to any kind of attack. But what I do worry about is that we become complacent at a time when everybody is concerned about COVID-19, when everybody's concerned about what is happening to others within a particular command, that we will become complacent and not pay enough attention to the potential threats that are out there.
Leon Panetta, a former defense secretary, director of the CIA, and former White House chief of staff, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Don't be afraid of COVID. Don't let it dominate your life. The perilous advice of President Trump yesterday, leaving Walter Reed Medical Center, the messages from world leaders and the behaviors they display have a deep impact on the response to the pandemic. According to new research, their words and actions can actually alter the course of an outbreak. Here's the world's Ilana Gordon.
Jay Van Bavel is crowdsourcing a problem. He's a psychologist and neuroscientist at New York University. When the pandemic hit, he posted a call on social media to get his peers to help him with a worldwide survey. Why do people choose to follow or ignore public health guidelines, like wearing a mask or social distancing? He got a lot of responses.
At least last count, there's 233, and I think we're still adding people as we get more data from around the world.
233 collaborators from nearly 70 countries, and they've already spotted a trend. People who voice a strong sense of national identity and care for others regardless of their politics were more likely to support public health policies. Van Bavel says national leaders have a lot to do with that.
That is where people are seeing their duty and a sense of purpose and willingness to make sacrifices.
Van Bavel says a good example of this kind of unifying leadership is where he's from, in Canada.
Political leaders in Canada talked about the pandemic in the same way. They expressed similar concerns and took it equally seriously.
Another example, New Zealand.
Where their prime minister, Jacinda Ardern, has referred to the New Zealanders as her team of 5 million people. So framed it through a national identity.
It doesn't surprise Van Bavel that the country is the poster child for managing COVID-19. He says there was an early incident when Ardern went to a restaurant that was at capacity due to COVID-19 health guidelines.
And so instead of demanding that someone give up their table or that they make room for her and violating her own country's guidelines, she waited outside until it was safe.
He says that kind of positive role modeling appeared to have an impact on New Zealanders. But it's doubtful you'd ever see Brazil's president, Jair Bolsonaro, do that. He got COVID-19 this summer, but almost mocked it. That's according to Paulo Bojo, a professor of psychology at McCain's University in Sao Paulo and one of Van Bavel's collaborators.
He just said, you see, I'm here, I'm fine, so it's just a little flu.
He says Bolsonaro has downplayed the pandemic and put the problem of how to fight it in the hands of his citizens.
He also says something like, if you stay at home, you're going to starve and die. So you need to be a man and get out of your house and go work.
Worldwide, Brazil has the third largest number of infections and second highest number of deaths from COVID-19. Another country badly hit by the pandemic is the UK. Alexander Jehovska is at the University of Kent and works with Van Bavel on the global survey. She says after Prime Minister Boris Johnson got sick, he encouraged people to protect themselves with masks and social distancing and called for the nation to come together. In some ways, that approach worked. But members of his government haven't always followed the rules, and there are troubling signs that the public is losing trust.
So it seems clear that leaders' behaviors and leaders' response to also other people's breaking the rules can have important impact on how the public responds.
Which brings us back to the United States and President Trump. Van Bavel says in the U.S., the pandemic and public health measures have become especially politicized. He says the outbreak in the White House and Trump's own diagnosis could impact how Americans respond to the pandemic.
There was an opportunity to frame this as a national crisis, but instead in the United States, it was cast as a partisan issue. And our data suggests that that might have been unhealthy and potentially dangerous and fatal to many people.
For better or worse, Van Bavel and his team will have plenty of opportunities to study the role of national leadership and how individuals respond to the pandemic. For the World, I'm Alana Gordon.
There are proven ways to decrease the spread of the coronavirus. One of them is contact tracing, a bit of detective work to see who was in contact with an infected person. For example, after a White House event a week and a half ago turned into a possible super spreader incident, it would be useful to know who was there and who they've been interacting with since. That is apparently not happening. The White House has been opaque about its efforts to investigate that event on September 26, when the president introduced his Supreme Court pick Amy Coney Barrett. A number of people in attendance have since tested positive for COVID-19. Susie Welty has been following this. She's a global health expert at the University of California, San Francisco, and a contact tracer for COVID-19 in San Francisco. According to a report from the New York Times, the White House has stopped doing contact tracing for guests and staff at that event altogether, and has even turned down help from the CDC. What's your reaction to all of this, Susie?
You know, I obviously think that is not the right move. Contact tracing, testing, and tracing is basically the only public health containment strategy we have right now. We can't think that people at these events live in their own bubble. They go back to their families, they go back to their communities, they go out to restaurants. So they're constantly exposing other people, even if they tested negative immediately or in subsequent days. As we know, the incubation period is 14 days, so they could test positive any time in there. And be infecting a lot of other people in the meantime. So, you know, not doing contact tracing, not alerting the local health jurisdictions is, I think, hugely problematic in terms of the spread of COVID.
Right. And you've been working as a contact tracer in San Francisco for the last few months. Explain what you've come to understand about the importance of contact tracing as a tool when it comes to containing COVID.
It's so essential because you basically this disease is, you know, very transmissible, and also this incubation period of 14 days makes it really hard to contain. So asking people who have been exposed to quarantine for 14 days is really, really important. And that's what we do as contact tracers, is appeal to people's sense of community and their sense of social responsibility to not expose other people to a potentially deadly virus that they may have contracted.
So getting exposed individuals into quarantine is obviously important, but prior to that, the actual tracing part of contact tracing, how does that work? Say you get in touch with someone who has been exposed, what should they be telling you?
The first step is case investigation, and that's a report comes in from a lab that there's a positive test. A case investigator reaches out to that person, finds out who they've been in contact with for more than 15 minutes, less than 6 feet. In the 48 hours before they showed symptoms or tested positive, that's when they were most infectious. Then a contact tracer reaches out to those people and says, we're asking you to monitor yourself, to get tested, but also to stay home for 14 days during this incubation period where you could become infectious.
If someone is infected or has been exposed to someone infected, is it ill-advised for them to be out campaigning and doing public events as both Trump and Joe Biden have been doing? I mean, even if they're wearing masks?
It still would just be common sense that you don't get large groups together right now, and you do your campaigning virtually.
How much of a domino effect could it have if the White House is not doing robust contact tracing around this Rose Garden event? And if the public sees that the White House is not taking these precautions, is it possible other people won't either?
That's the unfortunate thing, is that this should be an example of how we can work together and how we can care for our community by doing the very basic, what our public health experts are asking us to do. And that isn't happening. In terms of a domino effect, I mean, he's a super spreader who's been in at least, you know, 5-6 states in the period. Pence keeps traveling, even though if he were a regular citizen, he would be in quarantine because he's been in close contact with a known case or several known cases. He's testing negative, but he'll test negative until he tests positive if he's infected. So that is, you know, hugely problematic. And there could be clusters of cases in so many states.
Susie Welty is a global health expert at the University of California, San Francisco, and a contact tracer for COVID-19 in San Francisco. Susie, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. This year, we've been following first-time Latino voters as part of our reporting project every 30 seconds. Young Latinos make up a critical voting block in the U.S. About every 30 seconds, a Latino hits voting age and becomes eligible to cast a ballot. Their choices in battleground states like Arizona could help decide the presidency. With less than a month to go, before Election Day, we caught up with Adela Diaz, who is casting her vote this week. KJZZ's Michelle Marisco has our story.
I first met Adela Diaz on an idyllic warm day on the University of Arizona campus. It was February, and the first victim of the coronavirus in the U.S. had already died, but nobody knew that yet. Throngs of students walked by meeting for lunch. They played frisbee on the main lawn. Arizona's totemic saguaro cactus were just showing the first signs of a spring bloom.
I remember somebody approached us and tried to get us to sign some kind of petition.
Hello, guys. Are you guys registered to vote here in Arizona?
Yes, sir.
9 months later, and all that's changed. 1 million people have died of the virus, and Adela's own life was upturned. Her college years reduced to an apartment, a packed class schedule on Zoom, and a laptop. But recently, she made a rare trip to campus.
Some guy approached me with a petition, and his mask was on incorrectly. Like, it wasn't covering his nose. And I was like, how dare you? How dare you walk up to me with the audacity with this petition? And I just gave him the dirtiest look.
Arizona is a battleground state. Both President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden are fighting for a large number of undecided voters. That's why the two candidates keep coming back to Arizona to campaign. Among Latinos, polls find Biden ahead, sometimes 2-1. He's been running this ad in Arizona.
In the midst of this god-awful pandemic, we've seen even more clearly than ever how much we rely on people with Hispanic roots to keep our country running.
Adela is not undecided, though. She's made up her mind. But it's been a journey. When we first met, she strongly supported Senator Elizabeth Warren. Then she hoped Senator Bernie Sanders would win. Now she's not so much voting for Biden as she is against Trump. At first, she thought the president would tackle the pandemic with full force.
It's not going to be a problem. There's a virus in China. There's a couple cases here. Ebola got here. It was fine. I just assumed it was going to be contained.
Instead, Adela says Trump worked to divide the country on its fault lines, from race to masks.
That man can't represent me. He doesn't even want to. He would never have me in mind as someone who he's making policies and fighting for. He wouldn't even pretend.
Adela, who's studying public health, has been consistent about what she wants in a president, universal health care. That's also the top issue for her roommate, Alexa Basualdo. She is planning to focus on nuclear medicine. Her recent coursework involved scrutinizing the top virus vaccine candidates. Like Adela, Alexa is also a first-time voter. Her favorite aspect of Biden? Kamala Harris.
He was very particular with his vice president candidate. He was very methodical about it, really wanted to please the voters. And so that tells me that he's listening to us.
Biden also wasn't her first choice, but she wants Trump out. Adela says she's never been clear about that too. She also has another hope that a vaccine will emerge soon and be distributed fairly.
I'm hoping that someone who's in charge of this focuses on low-income areas to distribute it.
Erasing health inequalities. Adela's been consistent about her hope for that during an inconsistent political year. For The World, I'm Michel Marisco, Tucson, Arizona.
When the Trump administration talks about Latin America, one country that gets mentioned a lot is Venezuela. More than 5 million people have fled Venezuela's economic and social collapse. That's led to a humanitarian crisis across the region. The Trump administration has put tough sanctions on Venezuela, a foreign policy and campaign gambit, and that's made many Venezuela watchers ask, have the Trump policies done more harm than good? The World's Latin America correspondent Jorge Valencia reports.
In mid-September, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo went on a tour of South America. The countries he visited, Colombia, Brazil, and Guyana, weren't the actual focus of his tour. Rather, it was their neighbor, Venezuela. It was the latest show of the Trump administration's support for opposition leader Juan Guaido, and it was a gesture that did not escape Venezuelan President Nicolás Maduro.
Mike Pompeo anda en una gira guerrerista contra Venezuela.
Mike Pompeo is on a guerrilla tour against Venezuela, Maduro said in a televised statement. And he is failing in his attempt to organize other countries against us, Maduro said. Andres Cañizales is a political scientist at the Catholic University in the city of Barquisimeto.
Sí, claro, obviamente fue no solamente en Barquisimeto, en Venezuela, digamos, fue una noticia.
Cañizales says Pompeo's circuit around Venezuela was big news in his city and across the country. He says that's because international efforts to oust President Maduro are always noticed, and also because Maduro's antagonist of choice is the United States.
Sí, yo creo que sí, digamos, en el caso del gobierno de Nicolás Maduro en particular.
So Cañizales says that, yes, Maduro's government is likely paying attention to the U.S. election. And yes, they might prefer a Joe Biden administration because it may be slightly less punitive. But Cañizales says U.S. efforts to oust embattled President Nicolás Maduro aren't working anyway, so the country's problems will persist.
Bueno, hemos estado largas semanas sin gasolina, es decir, entonces eso afecta prácticamente toda la vida de la sociedad.
Drivers in Venezuela have had little to no access to gasoline for weeks, Cañizales says. That means no gasoline to transport food, to transport medical patients, not even to transport cadavers. That's partially because of U.S. sanctions making it almost impossible for Venezuela to import oil.
Pero la otra parte de la verdad, insisto, tiene que ver con cómo se destruyó a lo que era la joya de la corona.
But Cañizales says it's mostly because Nicolás Maduro and his predecessor, Hugo Chávez, all but dismantled Venezuela's state-run oil company. Still, the Trump administration is prioritizing sanctions against Venezuela, and it probably has something to do with electoral politics in the battleground state that is Florida, says Frank Mora, a political scientist at Florida International University.
Miami is probably one of the very few places where a foreign policy issue is a domestic political issue.
Mora says Trump's campaign has purposely courted American voters of Venezuelan and Cuban backgrounds who oppose undemocratic governments in Venezuela and Cuba and who could tip the scale in Florida.
And it's really about trying to keep that Venezuelan and Cuban vote on his side. That's a calculation he's making. I'm not sure it's going to play itself out that way, but that's certainly clearly what he's planning.
Mora says he believes the approach to Venezuela has been a miscalculation for both the Trump campaign and the Trump administration.
When you do foreign policy, you do things in the national interest. And yes, to help the Venezuelan people. But when you're making decisions based on domestic political calculations, you start making mistakes. And that's why the policy has been a failure.
Venezuela has an election of its own in December. The Maduro administration will hold the vote for parliament, and members of the opposition have already said they will not participate. Whether or not the U.S. recognizes the winners of that election will be up to whomever wins the White House in November. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia.
We'll be right back. You're with The World. Away from the hustle and bustle of Bogota, Colombian musician Simon Mejia hears a new rhythm. Birds now harmonize with his electronic beats.
When I live in the city, I have my alarm clock, you know, with the phone and everything. Now my alarm clock are those sounds.
An exploration of music and nature in one man's backyard. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World from GBH Boston and PRX. Thousands of women are in detention camps in northern Syria. They are the wives and widows of ISIS fighters. Their homes are far away in Europe and Central Asia, but they're raising their children in tent cities controlled by the U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces. Some women have escaped. They hire human traffickers to smuggle them out and pay them with money raised through crowdfunding campaigns in the camps. Vera Miranova is a writer based in Vermont. She's the author of From Freedom Fighters to Jihadists. Vera, you've also been to northern Syria, where a lot of these camps are. The biggest detention camp, in fact, is in this area. Can you tell us about the conditions in these detention camps generally?
Those are detention camps where more than 100,000 ISIS-affiliated families are located. So, of course, as anything of that scale, it's very hard to ensure a good quality living, basically. On the other side, those camps are not the worst refugee camps, let's say, in the world. So, you know, it's not pleasant there. It's not a five-star living, but compared to other temporary accommodation of same kind, they're quite livable.
So I know the women there come from many places around the world, some from countries that will not allow them to return because of their allegiance to ISIS at one point. Can you just introduce us to, say, one woman who has escaped from a camp, and where did she escape to?
She was not a high-level ISIS at all. Her husband was killed, so she was living in a camp, but then her parents helped her with money to escape. And she went to Idlib, where she lives now, but because Idlib is not exactly friendly to ISIS women from camps, she is trying to get married with a local foreign fighter in order to be legitimate.
Do you have any news about her escape?
I mean, she escaped. It's like a 2 days event, right? So she's living already for like a year in Idlib. I would approximate that so far, thousands of women escaped from camps in northern Syria, the foreign women. So their first destination is Idlib, which is under control of Hayat Tahrir al-Sham right now. And then they could stay there or proceed to Turkey and other countries through Turkey. In Turkey, there is a big group of women who escaped and went to Turkey in order to surrender to their home country embassy. So their home country refused to take them from camp, but by law, they could not refuse if the person who is wanted shows up in the embassy. So that's basically how they were taken home.
How many of the women who escape have children and see that escape is the only way for their kids to have a somewhat good chance of leading a decent life?
I mean, approximately 99% of women in the camp have kids from 1 to 7. And also, we should not forget that some of them have not their own kids, but they also take care of orphans of women and men who died fighting for ISIS.
So the crowdfunding aspect of this is kind of fascinating, raising money to pay a trafficker to get these women out of these detention camps. Just describe briefly how it's done.
Because it's so easy to start crowdfunding, there is a lot of competition between them. So right now you have more women asking for money than those willing to donate, right? So they have to become interesting. For example, if they're starting their own channel on Telegram, they need first, before they ask for money, they need to increase numbers of subscribers. So they are choosing a particular niche. For example, members from Baghouz, the last stronghold of ISIS, or news from the camp, or religious advices, and so on. So they're kind of becoming like a newspaper, let's say. So when number of followers is big enough, that's when she starts asking for donations.
Do the women inside the camp ever make the classic kind of crowdfunding video to convince people to contribute?
Absolutely. There are a couple of YouTube channels coming from Al-Hol for that purpose.
Al-Hol, that's one of the camps.
They do videos, they do audio, everything. They're very sophisticated now. They really are.
Right. And where are these crowdfunding pitches actually posted?
Facebook, Telegram channels.
So kind of the classic places where you would do a crowdfunding campaign.
Absolutely, like nothing different. I know at least two women who started crowdfunding on a GoFundMe platform.
Vera, you've written that some women in the camps will never be able to go home, and yet they're fundraising. Why do you think that is?
I know one woman who is getting money from Europe from a guy who supports ISIS in Europe, and she does not want to escape. No, she's waiting for her government to take her home. And she's not pro-ISIS anymore. Mm. But she was like, I have to pretend that I'm ISIS because I need to feed my kids.
Oh. Vera Mironova is the author of From Freedom Fighters to Jihadists. She's been telling us about women and families of foreign fighters crowdfunding to pay for their escape from detention camps in Syria. Vera, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
It's been a long year, and the coronavirus has warped all sense of time. So it's easy to forget that back in January, we were looking at the real possibility of war breaking out between the U.S. and Iran. The U.S. had assassinated a top Iranian military commander near the airport in Baghdad, and in response, Iranian-backed militias fired rockets at U.S. forces stationed in Iraq.
The Pentagon says at least two sites were hit in Erbil and al-Assad, west of Baghdad. It says the missiles were launched from Iran itself. Iranian state
10 months later, tensions with Iran are still high, and that begins to explain why Iranians are paying such close attention to the U.S. presidential race, wondering what the next 4 years might bring. The world's Shirin Jafari reports.
Most news media inside Iran is state-controlled. So many people get their news on satellite television channels from abroad. This is the BBC Persian Language Service reporting on President Trump's recent illness. The program is produced in the UK, beaming straight into the Islamic Republic. Amir runs an animation studio in Tehran. He didn't want me to use his last name because he fears retribution from authorities. These days, he says, he's glued to social media and satellite channels to keep up with news about the presidential elections in the U.S. Honestly, he says, this election has more impact on my life than any other election here in Iran. For Amir and so many other Iranians, the next occupant of the White House holds immense power over their day-to-day lives. They might live thousands of miles away from Washington, D.C., but the policies of the next U.S. president could make a big difference on security, sanctions, and the economy in Iran. For example, Amir explains, he wants to work with clients in places like Dubai, Canada, and the U.S., but because of American sanctions, he can't open up a bank account outside of Iran. That means he can't be paid by foreign clients and he can't purchase equipment abroad. Officials in the Trump administration say this is exactly the point of U.S. sanctions, to isolate Iran from the international community, to squeeze its economy so hard that Iran's government comes back to renegotiate a new nuclear deal. Here's Elliot Abrams on CNN yesterday. He's the U.S. special envoy for Venezuela and Iran.
There's never been this kind of pressure. And we will keep it going and we will increase it, as you'll see in the coming days and weeks.
Trump officials say that Iran supports terrorism and destabilizes the Middle East, and that Iran should never be allowed to get nuclear weapons. 2 years ago, President Trump walked away from the Iran nuclear agreement that was signed and negotiated by the Obama administration. Whether we like it or not, we have to follow U.S. politics, says 21-year-old Nasser Muharram, a graphic designer from Tehran. I think even Americans don't pay as much attention to their election as much as we do, he says jokingly. Muharram has been reading up on the mechanics of presidential elections, on the Electoral College and popular vote, for example. It can get complicated, he says. Last month, President Trump predicted that Iran will renegotiate a new nuclear deal with the U.S.
Within maybe, literally a very short time, you'll have Iran coming back and saying, let's get this whole thing worked out. Iran,
I think he is making such remarks for the domestic use in the elections.
This is Abbas Aslani,
senior fellow at the Center for Middle East Strategic Studies based in Tehran.
Aslani says Iranians have been looking elsewhere for trade partners that can help with their economy.
Iran has been trying to somehow work with its neighbors, or at least with countries who are ready to work with it despite the U.S. sanctions.
Like China and Russia, for example. As for renegotiating a deal, Iran's foreign minister Javad Zarif seems skeptical. He blames the U.S. for quitting the deal that was signed by 7 countries.
None of those parties got all they wanted. Now, they cannot come back now and say, I want to get everything that I wanted because I didn't get it the first time around.
Abbas Aslani, who reported on the nuclear negotiations for an Iranian news website, says he expected a bumpy road.
Making the deal was not the ending point, but that was the beginning.
Joe Biden was vice president when the talks took place, and he has said that if he wins the election, he'll be open to diplomacy with Iran. For now, many Iranians are holding their breath as Americans go to the polls next month. And Nasser Muharram, the graphic designer in Tehran, has a message for U.S. voters. He says, I understand that domestic policies are important for Americans. It makes sense. It's their life, their future. But Muharram adds that he hopes voters will also take the time to learn about how the candidates will guide U.S. foreign policy. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Here in the U.S., many schools have kept their doors closed because of the pandemic. Greece went the opposite direction. The government there decided to open schools for in-person learning last month, despite an uptick in COVID-19 cases. Now, students, parents, and teachers at hundreds of schools throughout the country are protesting what they say are unsafe conditions in the classroom. From Athens, here's the world's Lydia Emanuelidou with our story.
It's a 8:15 in the morning, what would normally be the start of the school day for students at this Athens area high school. But instead of settling into their desks, students are gathering in the schoolyard. They chained the school's metal fence entrance and locked themselves inside. And they're gearing up for a vote. 17-year-old senior Vagelis Okaro says this vote will determine if students take control of the school grounds and lock teachers and administrators out. These occupations or sit-ins are common in Greece, especially at the beginning of the school year. Students protest things like lack of funding and a need for more teachers. But these protests are happening in an unprecedented way now at hundreds of schools throughout the country. Student organizers say that's because COVID-19 safety measures in schools are inadequate. This morning, the students vote to occupy the school. They've done that for the last week. Those who dissented go home. No class for anyone today. It's a shame, says Maria Dondi, a parent here, as she waits for her 15-year-old first year outside the school. When schools first opened in mid-September, she says, she was a bit worried about her daughter's health. But now, she's more concerned about her missing so much class and falling behind during a critical time. We can't afford to get tutors or private lessons, she tells me. Here in Greece, high school grades and standardized test scores arguably matter even more than they do in the U.S. They determine where students can go to college and even what they're allowed to study. This is why many students, like 17-year-old Marios Kiroglou, don't agree with the occupations. But he says that while he and his peers might be split on how to protest conditions at schools, they all seem to agree there is reason to protest. For one, he tells me, there are just too many people in each class. The limit right now is 27 people. That's set by the Greek Ministry of Education. Students are supposed to each get their own desk, but many tell me they have to share because there just aren't enough. So they can't social distance. While Greece was lauded early on for its swift response to the pandemic and for managing to keep infection numbers low, critics say the administration of Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis has made a series of missteps recently, especially on the schools issue. Anna Pendotti, a senior, says some of those missteps are laughable. For example, she says, the masks they gave out to students and teachers at the beginning of the year were a fiasco. A fiasco because they were huge. Students trolled the government on social media by posting photos of them covering their entire face under the hashtag Maskes Alexiptota, parachute masks. We give the administration the Gen Z treatment, i.e. trolling, says Efremia Kalogiru, another senior. She tells me the reason she doesn't feel safe in school is because not everyone wears masks, even though they're required. She says she has a teacher who doesn't believe in wearing masks. Kalogiru sits in the front row, and she says this teacher gets close to her and sometimes even coughs in her direction. She tried to talk to him about it, but he dismissed her. Other students tell me about parents who refuse to let their kids wear a mask at school. At the beginning of the school year, some parents even created anti-mask groups on Facebook and got thousands of members. The teachers at this school refused to speak, so I talked to one at another school. Fifth grade teacher Dionysia Micha developed a fever and is waiting on the results of a COVID test she took. Micha says she had to pay for the test out of her own pocket. I ask her if the Greek government has provided any testing at schools for teachers or students. Nothing, she says. Meanwhile, confirmed cases of COVID-19 have led at least 135 schools to shut down partially or completely. And within the first 2 weeks of schools, there was a 30% jump in kids testing positive for COVID. Miha's school is open, but she says the last few weeks have been pretty miserable. She says it's hard to teach with a mask on all day. She hates that she's not allowed to pat her students on the back when they do a good job. Ideally, Miha says she would be able to do school online, but many students who don't have access to their own computer or good internet would be left behind. So Miha wants schools to stay open, but she wants fewer students in the class and more teachers hired to accommodate smaller classrooms. These are some of the same demands thousands of students, parents, and teachers made when they took to the streets of Athens last week. They also want rapid tests for students and teachers, more cleaning personnel to disinfect classrooms, among other things. They say the Department of Education hasn't engaged with them on any of their demands. I reached out to the department, too, several times, but didn't hear back. Whatever their battlefield, in schoolyards, in streets, online, students, teachers, and parents say they'll keep fighting to keep themselves safe while also keeping schools open. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou in Athens, Greece.
Whether we take you inside Greek schools dealing with a pandemic or looking at how U.S. elections may impact foreign policy, you tune into The World to connect with the rest of the globe. Connect with us on social media and share with others the stories that stick with you. You can also connect with our journalists who reported them. Follow us on Twitter. We're at The World. It's been 24 years since Brits saw a new episode of the political satire Spitting Image. The UK's award-winning comedy show features caricature puppets of celebrities and politicians like former Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher.
I will have a steak.
How'd you like it?
Oh, raw, please.
And what about the vegetables?
Oh, they'll have the same as me.
Spitting Image puppets doing caustic political humor. Just when politicians thought the coast was clear, the show is back with a lineup full of world leaders and topical commentary. Just in time for this era of insanity. The reboot's first episode begins outside a cafe with customers gushing over life in New Zealand.
What a fantastic day in New Zealand. Meat pies, ginger crunch, and a positive balance of trade with China.
New Zealand sounds almost utopian. Another customer in the cafe raises a question.
But sometimes I think, couldn't things here be more fantastic?
Magical flute music is the cue for what looks like Mary Poppins floating down from the clouds with Auckland Sky Tower in the background, except it's not Mary Poppins.
Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern!
Kia ora, children. What healthful weather we're having. Not a spit spot of virus to be seen.
The Prime Minister Ardern puppet there, referring to New Zealand's handling of the coronavirus. The real Jacinda Ardern has been praised for keeping infections way down during the pandemic. Fewer than 2,000 Kiwis have contracted the virus. They've only had 25 deaths since the start of the outbreak. Seems like a spoonful of sugar might be the thing to make the medicine go down for this Jacinda Ardern sketch. Instead, Spitting Image spoofed another hit from Mary Poppins.
In a world of strong men, a nice lady came along. I'm kind and smart and young and kind and good and kind and young. When I became New Zealand's boss, I knew just what to do. Initiate a nanny state and turn our pay skies blue.
Super Kiwi Socialistic Extra Nice Jacinda.
Super Kiwi Socialistic Extra Nice Jacinda. Yeah, you can even sing along to it. Mary Poppins ain't got nothing on Jacinda Ardern. The lyrics go on to list some of Ardern's most praiseworthy political moves, like banning semi-automatic weapons, enforcing a living wage, and putting New Zealanders into lockdown before the Yanks and Brits. But the Spitting Image puppet party is ruined when a man at the cafe starts coughing and the puppet prime minister has a word with him.
Young man, do you have the impertinence to be ill in New Zealand?
I was just clearing my throat. I'm probably fine.
I can see there's only one thing to do. I am delighted to announce no new cases of coronavirus.
Wow, when you can't control the body, you chop off the head. Clearly opposite of the reputation Prime Minister Ardern has created for herself. In a press conference, the real Jacinda Ardern said she watched the skit with her daughter Niamh.
I'm glad that I whipped Niamh away from watching it just in time near the end there. Yep.
Prime Minister Ardern is the first of more than 100 puppets developed for the show. Spitting Image producers say be on the lookout for upcoming skits with puppets of Donald Trump, Boris Johnson, Vladimir Putin, Xi Jinping, and members of the British royal family. And yes, Americans can watch too, thank goodness. Just tune into Facebook Watch each Monday for the latest episode. Climate change is on the minds of a lot of people around the world, and Simon Mejia is one of them. The founder and leader of the Colombian trio Bomba Estéreo has been at work on a new solo project called Monte. It's an exploration of birdsong, nature, and electronic music. Simon Mejia joins us from his home in Colombia. Thanks for being with us again, Simon. We spoke a couple of years ago when you were just starting to think about the whole idea of recording nature and how those sounds might interact with human-made music. So in the time since we last spoke, what's been the biggest lesson you've learned?
I learned about how I approach music, and I also learned a lot about nature, more from a sensitive, more like an unconscious and sonic way, which I found very beautiful, yeah.
Was it a surprise to you when you heard how your recordings from the forest worked in a musical composition?
Yeah, very much, because at the beginning I was making these recordings just for like an archive, like building an archive. I wasn't thinking about music. It became music as I started listening to them in my studio, and I started listening to some kind of patterns, because I don't think nature has patterns. It's more chaotic than the musical patterns we have in our heads. But that took me to put them into music.
It sounds like you really got dialed into the rhythms of nature. You knew what hours of the day things came alive.
Yeah, I learned, and it's funny also because now during quarantine, I live outside Bogotá, kind of in the countryside. Since I got here, I became more aware in the mornings at what exact time the sounds begin, no? So I don't have, when I live in the city, I have my alarm clock, no, with the phone and everything. Now my alarm clock are those sounds. You become more aware. And now during quarantine, many people that still live in Bogotá in the cities were telling me, like, wow, I'm listening to some birds like at 5 or 5:30 a.m. that I've never listened before.
Your project, Simon, called Monte, isn't just a sonic experiment. There's a song called Kakahika, features a singer named Candil Chauta from an indigenous group known as the Huisca. So tell us about meeting Candil and his community. What was it like making music together? Did you have a common language aside from music?
Yeah, well, actually, we've been long-time friends. We've been long-time friends because this Huisca community is, since ancient times, they have inhabited near Bogotá. This is their area. Common ground is that we both think that Earth and humanity is passing through a crisis, and that we need to address, to make changes for that to stop. We think the same. We don't have to go and live in the forest or in the Amazon jungle, or we don't have to leave our computers and our cars and our phones or whatever. But we can set in the middle of that a more sustainable and more harmonic way of respecting nature and treating nature as we depend from nature, you know?
Colombian musician Simon Mejia speaking with us from his country home just outside Bogotá. His latest album is called Mirla, which happens to be a bird native to Colombia. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston at GBH. I'm Marco Werman. Stay safe, stay healthy. We'll see you back here tomorrow.